Father, but is of the world. 1 John chapter 2, verse 15, Revised Standard Version. Consequently, in Christianity, nature is not a primary revelation of the divine. Rivers, trees, and stones are not perceived as alive and permeated with spirit, but rather as dead matter. The earth then becomes something to be conquered, subdued, observed, and studied. It becomes a big science project. Because of all this, we began to think of ourselves as separate from and innately superior to the rest of the planet. We lost the ability to identify with it at deep empathetic levels. In Christianity, this is even further undermined by a sacred intent to transcend the material earth and the flesh of our bodies, as is suggested in a verse from James chapter 1, verse 27. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to keep oneself unstained from the world. Revised Standard Version. Often the earth seems to function like a mere way station where we can grapple with our redemption before going up there to the realm of the Father, who is viewed as totally other than the earth and high above it. Christianity's unfortunate denial of matter, mother, also includes centuries of denial and hatred for the body with its cravings, instincts, and sexuality. In my early 20s, while at college in Texas, I went to church one Sunday and sat in the back row beside a woman who was holding a newborn baby in a pink bonnet. Halfway through the sermon, the baby got hungry. Babies do that. So the woman discreetly unbuttoned her dress and nursed the child beneath the bill of the pink bonnet. An usher noticed this, came over, and asked the woman to please leave. He was the picture of quiet indignance. He told her she could find a restroom down the hall. I can still remember the shame that spread over her face and the outraged scream the baby girl let out when the mother pulled her breast away. Women with their incessant menstruation, conception, pregnancy, childbirth, and lactation have been too visceral for patriarchal religion. In the Bible, women involved in these womanly conditions were considered unclean and were separated from men. They had to go through purifications before being allowed near men or things religious, and since birth and menses were considered dirty, women were in constant need of being spiritualized and sanitized. According to the attitude that sprang up, women could not be both holy and sexual. And as celibacy became a spiritual ideal in Christianity, men were more and more cast as spiritual and women as sexual. Woman's role was seen as the temptress, the femme fatale, who lured good men into the evils of flesh. Theologian Rosemary Radford Reuter sums it up when she says that Christianity became a body-fleeing, world-negating spirituality that projects upon the female all its abhorrence, hostility, and fear of the bodily powers from which it has arisen and from which it wishes to be independent. Despair and compassion. One day I was driving through town, my head full of the ideas and awareness I'd been gathering, when I saw a woman sitting on the steps of a business, her head in her hands. She wore a navy dress and brown coat, and she was crying. As I drove past her, I too started to cry. At first it made no sense that I was crying. I didn't know this woman. Then I realized I was not crying for her or for myself. I was crying for women. I was crying for the vast imbalance, the heart that had been lost, the rejection of the earth and body, the oppression and diminishment of things considered feminine. It was a suffering with, a despair I felt on behalf of something much larger than myself. I don't know what it was about the woman that triggered my despair, but for weeks after that I went through a period of grief. This is the grief that comes when you leave the city limits of your own wound and step into the vastness of the whole feminine wound, which is ultimately a human wound. Forming an honest feminist critique of our own faith tradition is not an easy thing to do. Betrayal of any kind is hard, but betrayal by one's religion is excruciating. It makes you want to rage and weep. It deposits a powerful energy inside. Eventually, that energy will flow out as either hostility or love. The energy must and will find a form, a shape in our lives. It is now, as we wade into the secret distress of the feminine and encounter the largeness of the wound, that we need to be very conscious and keep the despair we might feel from becoming channeled into bitterness, we have to work very hard to keep it flowing toward compassion. The tamper-proof bottle. During those months when I was forming my feminist critique, I watched a friend struggle to open a tamper-proof bottle of medication. She gripped, pushed down, squeezed, and turned it many times without results. "You try," she said. So I gripped, pushed, squeezed, turned, grunted, but I couldn't budge it either. "What's wrong with this thing?" I said. "It's doing its job," she replied, "only it's doing it a little too well." Later, I couldn't help but compare that bottle to Christianity's rigid tradition concerning women. The words tamper-proof and tradition have similar intents. Tradition comes from the Latin traditio, which means a delivery. The Christian tradition is a delivery of opinions, dogmas, rites, practices, and customs from one generation to the next. That delivery is its job. The essential intent within tradition is its need to perpetuate itself, to keep delivering, to remain untampered with. I thought to myself, when it comes to tradition, the church is certainly doing its job, but perhaps it's doing it a little too well. Viewing tradition in this way, we can easily see why restricting women to narrowly defined and subordinate places reproduces itself, why change comes slowly or not at all, or on the margins and not at the core. Years earlier, I'd taken a seminary course on church history, but nothing had been mentioned about its patriarchal underpinnings. Now I wanted to explore the tamper-proof traditions concerning women. Why hadn't the church accepted women as equal participants? How had all of this come to be? Searching for answers, I turned to theologians Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza, Phyllis Tribble, Elaine Pagels, Rosemary Radford Reuter, Mary Daly, and other women who were voicing truths that had once been unsayable. In the evenings, I sometimes read a paragraph to my husband, just to test his response. "Dr. Schussler Fiorenza at Harvard says the intention of Jesus was feminist," I said to Sandy one evening. "Mine too," he said. "He's a smart man, my husband." I believe Sandy's intention was that, derived from a concept he held in his mind of equality and justice. But like me, like so many of us, he lived with an unconscious gap between concept and practice. Most feminism doesn't filter down into ways of relating, the way faith is practiced or votes are cast. I've seen churches give honest lip service to women's equality as a concept, while life and worship there go on in the same old patriarchal ways. But Sandy was embracing the ideal, and I was glad at least for that. After that night, I began to mention other ideas from books I was reading. Sandy listened, nodded, when I began to weave in more personal fragments about the awakening I was experiencing. He listened then, too, but he didn't nod so much anymore. One rain-soaked weekend, when the children were off with friends and Sandy was away for a conference, I read practically non-stop, making a breathtaking discovery. I found that within early Christian history, there had been two traditions regarding women. The first we could call the revolutionary tradition, which included Jesus's feminist and egalitarian intent and practice. This tradition, preaching a gospel of liberation and mutuality, treated women as equals. Evidence exists that Christian women carried out priestly functions, teaching, baptizing, and blessing the Eucharist, on a par with men. But soon another tradition asserted itself. The patriarchal tradition, with its anti-female, body-negating spirituality, insisting on the dominant cultural taboos and sanctions concerning women. This tradition, which had started long before Christianity, viewed women as naturally inferior and so as the property of men, associating women with matter, flesh, evil, and sin. For a while, these two traditions, the revolutionary and the patriarchal, clashed, but soon the revolutionary tradition was stamped out, sealing an interpretation of women as inferior that has continued to this day. For a brief moment in history, a window of opportunity to reverse patriarchy opened, and then it was slammed shut. I can still remember the sense of loss that washed over me when I read Elaine Pagels's words. Despite the previous activity of Christian women, by the year 200, the majority of Christian communities had endorsed as canonical the pseudo-Pauline letter of Timothy, which stresses and exaggerates the anti-feminist element in Paul's views. Let a woman learn in silence with all submissiveness. I permit no woman to teach or to have authority over men. She is to keep silent. By the end of the second century, women's participation in worship was explicitly condemned. After this, Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire, and 312 CE, taking on even more patriarchal attitudes. The pattern of keeping women from full participation became set, uniform, and institutionalized in Christianity. Because of women's so-called inherent sinfulness, and the belief by church leaders that women did not even have souls to save, two methods were devised by which women could find salvation. One was submission in marriage and in childbearing, the other was virginity. Both models involved roles of silence and subordination in which the stigma of being female could be overcome, writes Anne E. Carr. That same weekend, I reread the parts of the Bible related specifically to women. If you do this all at once, it can be a shock. A number of years later, I would come upon an article in the Atlantic Monthly on women and the Bible that summarized the kind of awareness I gained that weekend as I read through the scripture. The article said, "The Bible is no stranger to patriarchy. It was written mostly, if not entirely, by men. It was edited by men. It describes a succession of societies over a period of roughly 1,200 years whose public life was dominated by men. It talks almost only about men. In the Hebrew Bible as a whole, only 111 of the 1,426 people who are given names are women. The proportion of women in the New Testament is about twice as great, but still leaves them a tiny minority. As a prescriptive text, moreover, the Bible has been interpreted as justifying the subordination of women to men. In pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Wives, be subject to your husband, as you are to the Lord. Indeed, man was not made from woman, but woman from man, neither was man created for the sake of woman, but woman for the sake of man." As a text that has been presumed by hundreds of millions of people to speak with authority, moreover, the Bible has helped enforce what it prescribes. As I moved through the biblical material, I flipped over to Galatians chapter 3, verse 28, where Paul put forth a luminous statement that in Christ there is no male or female. I thought how unfortunate that this did not become the centerpiece for Christian tradition. What took hold more firmly were other statements attributed to Paul, upholding male dominance and female subordinates, forbidding women from prophesying, demanding they cover their heads when they prayed in public, an outward sign that they were under the authority of men. At times I put the books down and paced in agitation. Other times I sat staring at sheets of water slide down the windows, too sad to turn the page. But I formed my consciousness by turning pages that weekend, and for months to come. I found shocking statements about women by church fathers and leaders I'd once looked to for guidance, Jerome, Clement, Aquinas, Luther, Bonhoeffer, Teilhard de Chardin. But perhaps no church father had such a profound and encompassing impact on shaping the foundations of Christian interpretation as Augustine, whose thinking, I discovered, was patriarchal in the extreme. How odd, I kept thinking, that the same man who wrote, "Our hearts were made for thee, O Lord, and they are restless until they rest in thee," also wrote, "Man but not woman is made in the image and likeness of God." In 1140, this actually became an official decree of the church. Over the months, the most amazing picture unfolded before me, a picture women have rarely glimpsed. Catholic theologian Elizabeth A. Johnson sums it up. "For most of the church's history, women have been subordinated in theological theory and ecclesial practice at every turn. Until very recently, they have been consistently defined as mentally, morally, and physically inferior to men, created only partially in the image of God, even a degrading symbol of evil. Women's sexuality has been derided as unclean, and its use governed by norms laid down by men. Conversely, they have been depersonalized as a romantic, unsexed ideal whose fulfillment lies mainly in motherhood. They are called to honor a male savior sent by a male god whose legitimate representatives can only be male, all of which places their persons precisely as female in a peripheral role. Their femaleness is judged to be not suitable as metaphor for speech about God. In a word, women occupy a marginal place in the official life of the church. It was all a sobering indicator of the kind of soil in which Christianity grew. Even more sobering was the realization that after 2,000 years, so much was still being harvested from it. Eden as wounded geography. On a day in early November, while thumbing through a book, I came upon a picture of Eve being tempted by the serpent. I gazed at it a long time, the snake whispering in Eve's ear, her hand outstretched to receive the apple. It brought to mind the classic interpretation that Adam, the symbolic man, was the superior one, the agent of God, while Eve, the symbolic woman, succumbed to evil because of her association with the snake. Woman was blamed for bringing evil into the world. Her punishment, we're told, was women's pain in childbirth and submission to man. During my reading, I'd come across a number of references concerning the symbolic history of the serpent. To my surprise, I'd learned that in ancient times, the snake was not maligned or seen as evil, but rather symbolized female wisdom, power, and regeneration. It was associated with the ancient goddess and was portrayed as her companion. The snake was perhaps the central symbol of sacred feminine energy. Frankly, at the time, this made for uneasy reading. I glossed over those references. I think it was the word goddess. It's hard to describe the sort of anxiety the word created in me, as if the word itself were contraband. It seemed to violate a taboo so deep and ingrained, I felt stabs of irrational fear just reading about it, as if any minute witch burners from the 16th century might appear and carry me off. An uneasy reaction to the word goddess is common among women. Thousands of years of repression, hostility, and conditioning against a divine mother have made a deep impression on us. We've been conditioned to shrink back from the sacred feminine, to fear it, to think of it as sinful, even to revile it. And it would take a while for me to deprogram that reaction, to unpack the word, and realize that in the end, goddess is just a word. It simply means the divine in female form. That day, as I gazed at the picture of Eve and the serpent, I remembered goddess and her connection to the snake, and inside I heard a resounding click. I remembered how Nell Morton once described a moment of awareness in her feminist journey. My whole life just fell open, and I began to see why things have happened as they have happened. I began to understand what she meant. Questions followed one another in rapid-fire succession. How had the snake of all creatures, an animal no better or worse than other wild beings, come to embody the full projection of evil within the Jewish and Christian traditions? Why was the snake selected to represent Satan in the origin myth? Could it be that the patriarchal force chose the snake in hopes of diminishing women's connection to feminine wisdom, power, and regeneration? Was it a way of discrediting the feminine divine? In the context of that time in history, the idea made gut-wrenching sense. In fact, later I would read many such theories by scholars, theologians, and historians. To understand why the Eden story is so important, we have to remember the extraordinary way origin myths operate in our psyches. In a way, humans are not made of skin and bone as much as we're made of stories. The Eden myth, perhaps more than any other, floats in our cells, informing our vision of ourselves and the world. Back when a battle for passage of the ERA was being waged in state legislatures, a man said to me, "You know what ERA stands for?" "Equal Rights Amendment," I said. "No," he said with a laugh, "it stands for Eve ruined Adam." Interesting, isn't it, how Eden and women's struggle for rights get tangled. Yet the impact the myth has on people today was brought home to me even more when I visited the High Museum of Art in Atlanta in 1994 to see an exhibition on the civil rights movement. The works portrayed the injustice and inhumanity inflicted on African Americans during the summer of 1964. At the conclusion of the exhibit, visitors were invited to pin their thoughts on a bulletin board. I was astonished to see one sheet of paper that said, "It's all women's fault. They brought evil into the world and continue to do so." Whether joke or serious statement, that worldview had come right out of Eden. Holding the picture of Eve and the serpent that day, I realized how significant and sad it is that in the story, Yahweh forever placed enmity between Eve and the snake. Taking symbolic history into account, we might say Yahweh placed enmity between Eve and her deep feminine source, her wisdom and power. What did it mean spiritually and psychologically for a woman to be at odds with that source? Wasn't this another way of portraying women's severed connection with their feminine souls? I came to realize that Eden is a wounded geography within women's lives, that part of my journey would be returning to this painful inner ground and redeeming the snake in my own psyche. Recognizing anger. Throughout this period of looking at Christian patriarchy for the first time, I felt deeply betrayed by a tradition I had served. I also became more aware of my anger. In the beginning, I'd felt the anger like a current, deep and distant, something molten and moving inexorably toward the surface. As it rose, I gave it few outlets, except for a pen thrown across the room, an outburst in the taxicab, and a few other passing flashes, I'd kept a lid on it. The church has been afraid of the power of anger. It has seemed to equate anger with sin. But was anger really sinful? What if the sin lies not in feeling the anger, but in what one does with the feeling? Most of my life, I'd run from anger as something that good daughters and gracious ladies did not exhibit. Perhaps the thing most denied to women is anger. Forbidden anger, women could find no voice in which publicly to complain. They took refuge in depression, writes Carolyn Heilbrunn. Her words came true for me. Without the ability to allow or the means to adequately express the anger, I began to slide into periods of depression. There were days that autumn when I had little energy to write or paint or even read. On days like that, I felt like somebody had switched off the lights inside. Part of the darkness was the grief that happens when you realize what's been done to women and what we've allowed to be done to us. Part of it was because I didn't know where this journey was taking me, and I was scared. And part of it was due to the loss I was starting to feel inside, the loss of feminine soul. But certainly a lot of it came because betrayal and anger sat in me like boulders and I couldn't move them. I desperately needed to give myself full permission to get angry. The permission finally happened in a most unexpected way. I was having lunch with a young woman who'd recently been ordained as a minister and was on the staff of a large church. When I asked about her work, she told me about one of the first Sundays she'd been allowed to conduct the worship. Before the service, she had met the senior minister in his study. She was wearing a pair of medium-sized gold earrings along with her clerical robe. Noticing the earrings, the minister asked her to remove them. "I don't think he wanted to call attention to my being a woman," she said. As she reported the event, my anger suddenly issued forth in a stream of fury, feelings of outrage and insult, pure, unblemished wrath. I wasn't responding to that one incident, I realized later, but to all of the injustice done to women. I'd given myself permission to get mad as hell. "Sorry," she said. "I didn't mean to cause you to get so angry." "Don't be sorry," I said. "It's about time we all got angry at this stuff." The violation of women is an outrage, and anger is a clear and justifiable response to it. As I released my anger more often and more consciously, the cycle of depression ended. I began to express the anger when my friend Betty and I got together and talked. She is good about letting me rant without interrupting. I pounded pillows. I poured the anger into my journals. I let it come. Yet anger needs not only to be recognized and allowed. Like the grief, it eventually needs to be transformed into an energy that serves compassion. Maybe one reason I had avoided my anger was that, like a lot of people, I had thought there were only two responses to anger, to deny it or to strike out thoughtlessly. But other responses are possible. We can allow anger's enormous energy to lead us to acts of resistance against patriarchy. Anger can fuel our ability to challenge, to defy injustice. It can lead to creative projects, constructive behavior, acts that work toward inclusion. In such ways, anger becomes a dynamism of love. Trusting your own feminine source. Going through the process of unnaming myself, forming a feminist critique, and questioning old certainties left me feeling unhinged, but it also created a space for my own feminine wisdom to break through. Little by little, I began to contact a feminine source within that didn't come from patriarchy or need to be validated by it. The source was a deep, ancient feeling place inside me, a place I hadn't known existed. This surprised me because it made me realize that what I sought was not outside myself. It was within me, already there, waiting. Awakening was really the act of remembering myself, remembering this deep feminine source. Inside, I carried the poem that says, "Oh, woman, remember who you are, woman. Woman, it is the whole earth." Signs of exit. My remembering began that same autumn when an old woman came to me in a dream. In the dream, I was standing in front of my Baptist church when suddenly she appeared at my side. I did not know it then, but this same figure would come to me often in dreams and meditations throughout my journey as a personification of feminine wisdom, and whenever she appeared, I learned to brace myself. Some grace and havoc were about to be set loose. In dreams, the wise old woman often symbolizes the feminine self or the voice of the feminine soul, and her coming can mark a turning point for women. This dream was my turning point. The old woman has shining white hair and a face that hangs in folds and furrows down to her shoulders. Her lips are apple red, and she carries a walking stick with a snake wound around it. I notice strange flashes in the air about her as if someone is shaking out gold glitter. She points to the church steeple. As she does, it changes from a steeple to a rocket ship aimed at the sky. The old woman shakes her head and says, "You think this will take you where you need to go? Think again." Crazy dream, crazy old woman, I told myself when I woke. But there was no denying she was a numinous figure with enormous energy and power. She lingered in my thoughts for days. Then one morning in late November, I sat by myself in the church balcony during Sunday service. My two children were sitting with friends. I don't recall why Sandy wasn't there. The minister was preaching. He was holding up a Bible. It was open, perched atop his raised hand as if a blackbird had landed there. He was saying that the Bible was the sole and ultimate authority of the Christian's life. The sole and ultimate authority. I remember a feeling rising up from a place about 2 inches below my navel. It was a passionate, determined feeling, and it spread out from the core of me like a current so that my skin vibrated with it. If feelings could be translated into English, this feeling would have roughly been the word no. It was the purest inner knowing I had experienced, and it was shouting in me, "No, no, no." The ultimate authority of my life is not the Bible. It is not confined between the covers of a book. It is not something written by men and frozen in time. It is not from a source outside myself. My ultimate authority is the divine voice in my own soul, period. I waited. Lightning did not strike. I looked around to see if people were staring. I was sure I must have said the word no out loud, but everyone seemed properly engrossed in the sermon. One woman was nodding in agreement with the minister, nodding so profusely that I saw the depth of my heresy by comparison. Later, I would think of Ibsen's play A Dollhouse, how Nora had done the same thing. At the point when she decides to go away and discover her own life, her husband asks, "Have you no religion?" Nora answers, "I am afraid, Torvald, I do not exactly know what religion is. I know nothing but what the clergyman said. He told us religion was this and that and the other. When I am away from all this and am alone, I will look into that matter too. I will see if what the clergyman said is true, or at all events, if it is true for me." This is a stupendous moment for a woman when she decides to live from her own inner guidance. It is, however, excruciatingly hard for a patriarchal daughter to accomplish. She may have to do it, as I did, in stages. What is held over her head is condemnation, even damnation. We've been led to believe that leaving the circle of orthodoxy means leaving the realm of truth. Typically, the church has considerable stake in our staying in the orthodox circle. It knows if we claim ultimate authority as something in ourselves, as some inchoate voice in our own souls, it has lost all power over us. We have rendered ourselves independent, outside its control. We have stepped out onto our own path. For some reason, this scares people senseless. It terrified me just pondering it. Women grow afraid at this moment because it means giving up a world where everything is neat and safe. In that world, we feel secure, taken care of. We know where we're going. Then we wake up and find the old way doesn't work, that it no longer fits our identity, that by clinging to it, we're cutting ourselves off from something profound. But we cling anyway because it's all we've got. We call our desire for security loyalty. We yearn for the something we've lost as women, but it's so unknown, so unbearably unknown. And then one day it all comes down to this. Can we trust ourselves, our inmost selves, our feminine wisdom? That day, sitting in church, I believed the voice in my belly. "The female soul resides in the guts, not in the head," wrote Clarissa Pinkola Estes. I think that morning my female soul was shouting for her life. I asked myself, how many times have I denied my innermost wisdom and silenced this voice? How many times can a woman betray her soul before it gives up and ceases calling to her at all? My heart pounded throughout the rest of the sermon. When we stood for the closing hymn, I slipped out of the pew and descended the steps two at a time, holding on to the rail, trying to steady my impulse to bolt from the place. It was like that feeling of being underwater and scrambling for the surface for air. 39 years in the fish tank had caught up with me. I walked toward the exit sign, my eyes locked on it. As I passed through the front door, light and wind hit my face, along with the scent of pine and wood smoke. The sun was glinting off everything, trees, sidewalk, car windshields. For a few seconds I stood on the steps, taking in breaths of air like I was storing it up. I waited in the car for the children. Sitting there, staring up at the church steeple, I remembered the dream I'd had, the old woman supported by her stick with a snake spiraling around it. I recognized her then as the image of my female wisdom. I also thought about wisdom in the Bible, the feminine aspect of God who is personified as a woman. I knew practically nothing about her, but I resolved I would find out. The voice in my belly was the voice of the wise old woman. It was my female soul talking, and it had challenged the assumption that the Baptist church would get me where I needed to go. She was saying that by clinging to that steeple, I was somehow living against my female soul. I eventually came to see that she was also challenging the androcentrism of the entire Christian church, its singular aim toward a male God in the sky. She was challenging the way it took me away from earth, matter, and the feminine ground of my being, fueling a dualism that had split me in two. "I'm not going back," I told my husband. It was late Sunday afternoon. He was on the patio filling the dog's water bowl with the garden hose. He thought I meant I wasn't going back for the evening service.
Fine,
he said. No, I mean, I'm never going back. He didn't say anything. He just stared at me. The water ran over the sides of the bowl. I walked over and turned off the spigot. I can't explain it exactly, I said. I just know I don't belong there. I have to leave. I've decided to join the Episcopal Church.
He was very uneasy, weighing everything he said. If you think that's best, I guess you have to do what you think is best.
The dam breaks. The following March, I was confirmed into the Episcopal Church. Of course, patriarchy was there, too, but leaving the Baptist Church was an important first step for me. It was an exercise in letting go, in trusting my feminine wisdom, trusting myself. I needed to do that, to know I could do that. But looking back, I think some half-conscious part of me was also seeking a last-ditch way to make it all work. Moving into the Episcopal Church, I was looking for a more compatible circle of orthodoxy. I thought if I could be surrounded by the liturgies, rituals, and Eucharist, the things I had missed in an evangelical church, maybe that would fix everything. Maybe it would be enough. So I plunged in. I went to the Episcopal Church regularly. I taught a class. I tried to focus on the ancient beauty within the Eucharist. I tried to connect with the sacredness of the liturgy. I knelt in the pew and crossed myself and tried very hard. I kept whispering to myself, maybe I can find a way to live within patriarchal hierarchy and theology. Take the good, ignore the rest. I won't think too much about what's not here. It will be okay, it really will. And in the newness of it, in my determination, I drank up the beauty and sacredness of the experience. Plus, there were the children to consider. They were, for me, the biggest concern of all. One evening that spring, I paused in the doorway of the kitchen and watched them, Anne sitting on the floor doing homework, Bob busy with a video game. I'd explained my decision to them to attend a different church, and they'd been fine with it. In fact, the whole family had come with me at times. And in the years ahead, Sandy and the children would become confirmed in the Episcopal Church themselves. But what if I challenged that institution? Not setting the proper and accepted religious example for them conjured up images of the bad mother, the worst mother. Yet wouldn't the example of a mother being true to her journey, taking a stand against patriarchy, and questing for spiritual meaning and wholeness, even when it meant exiting circles of orthodoxy, be a worthwhile example? As I looked at their faces, love filled me up. It was the wise and difficult love that reminds parents that all we can really do is be true to our own spiritual unfolding and trust that our examples will one day help them be true to theirs. For children have a guiding spiritual wisdom inside of them, too. As summer came and went, I noticed my sense of betrayal had not diminished. Sitting in church, listening to liturgies that excluded the feminine, feelings of restlessness, alienation, and anger began to well up again. I began to yearn for a sacred environment that could help me remember my deep feminine self. One day, finding myself at a luncheon with a male Episcopal priest, I bravely, maybe even naively, explained my feelings about women in the church. He patted my hand. He said, "It's counterproductive to get hung up on side issues like that." End of discussion. Autumn came. I kept trying. But Sunday after Sunday, I sat in church feeling a little like the Dutch boy with his finger plugging the dam. It seemed like I was holding back a reservoir of doubt, pain, and disillusionment. One cold Sunday morning, full of wind and flight, I went to church as usual. I sat on the last pew. I asked myself, since when is women's spiritual well-being a side issue? Where is the feminine standpoint in this service? Where are the earth, nature, mother? Where are the power and celebration of women? The dam broke. I knew right then and there that the patriarchal church was no longer working for me. The exclusive image of God as Heavenly Father wasn't working either. I needed a power of being that was also feminine,
I needed a sacred space free of the stain of sexism with core imagery that embraced the feminine, a space that welcomed women to places of power, engaged them fully as equals, and helped to heal their wound and empower their lives. Nearly 100 years earlier, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, one of the mothers of women's suffrage, wrote, "With faith and works, woman is the chief support of the church and clergy, the very powers that make her emancipation impossible." I sat quietly on the pew. I knew that despite how unthinkable and forbidden it was, I needed to move beyond religion in a patriarchal institution. This may not be true for every woman, but for me, it was crucial to my spiritual maturity and growth. At that moment, I took sole responsibility for my spiritual life. I went home with clarity about my feelings, but frightened by them nevertheless. Marriage and spiritual autonomy. My husband noticed my preoccupation.
"Something on your mind?" he asked.
When I finished telling him, I think he felt like the dam water had rolled over him, too. He'd been seemingly open, if a little reluctant, about my awakening experience thus far, but now he objected with the finality of a slammed door.
"I just wish you'd stop all this," he said.
"What is this?" I asked him.
"You know, this whole feminist thing."
He felt threatened. I could recognize that even then. He didn't want anything in our comfortable world to change. The next few weeks I struggled to stand my ground, the unfamiliar new soil of defiance. I was becoming more certain that I couldn't stay married in the same way, not in a relationship built on patriarchal values. I was asking myself, what will happen to this marriage if I claim real autonomy? How can I blend my spiritual quest as a woman with my marriage? During that time, I was reading the journals of May Sarton. One day, I came across this wise passage. "Women have to come to understand ourselves as central, not peripheral, before anything real can happen. We have to depend on ourselves. This cannot be done against men, and that's the real problem. It cannot be woman against man. It has to be woman finding her true self with or without man, but not against man." I adopted this as my guide, but it was difficult not to fall into adversarial confrontations. Over and over, out of his own fear, Sandy tried to talk me out of the powerful feelings erupting into my life. He would become logical, then angry, then frustrated. I think deep down he expected me to defer to his wishes. In her poem Cinderella, Anne Sexton suggests how far a woman will go for the prince. Drawing on Grimm's rather than Disney's version of the fairy tale, she records how Cinderella's sisters excitedly try on the glass slipper. When they find their feet too large, the eldest sister slices off her big toe in order to fit into it. The other sister chops off her heel. I did not want to amputate the new growth happening inside me, yet wearing the prince's slipper seemed to demand it. As a woman, I'd stuffed my feet into all kinds of slippers that assured me of winning patriarchy's love. When the cultural father told me I should be sweet, deferring, passive, silent, and secondary, I'd accepted those shoes and felt obliged to limp around in them for decades. When the church told me God was male only and relegated women to the peripheries, I'd sliced off a toe and put on that stance too. When the priest told me not to get hung up on the side issue of women, I'd taken on that standpoint, for a brief while anyway. Now it seemed my husband wanted me to cut away one of the most vital awakenings in my life in order to go on being the good princess. Years later, a friend said to me, "When a conventional wife with a conventional husband experiences a feminist awakening, there is bound to be a marital explosion." Now the explosion had come, and I kept telling him the matter was not man against woman or Sue against Sandy. Rather, it was change against stasis, freedom against control. It was only at night, when I lay in the darkness and thought about my marriage, that I doubted myself. Beneath all my brave pronouncements, part of me could not imagine risking my marriage. There had to be a way through this. But it wasn't only my marriage that held me back. I began to glimpse the chasm that lay between the inclinations of my soul and my ability to carry them out. I had had a clear, pure moment of knowing that compelled me to risk my religion and move beyond patriarchy at church and within my spiritual life. But actually doing it? Now that was something else altogether. And my career, could I actually risk that? Yet I was withering within these things. Internally, I felt trapped. Leaving the jar. While entangled in these feelings, I happened to hear about an experiment in which flies were sealed in an aerated jar and left for an extended period of time. Finally, the lid on the jar was removed, but, strange thing, the flies did not try to leave. Well conditioned by now, they no longer looked for the exit. They just kept circling the tight perimeters of the glass, going in their familiar patterns. Their reality had shrunk to that jar. It had become their entire world. It had become safe. Life beyond it had ceased to exist. I'm in the jar, I thought. I hadn't been able to leave the tight perimeters of the old confining way of being a woman. It had been my entire world, and I questioned whether I could live beyond its safety. Unlike the flies, however, I knew the lid was off. I'd struggled myself to open it, but now that I had, I couldn't seem to muster the daring and insurgent energy I needed to fly. It's a peculiar thing, isn't it, that a woman can prefer the safety of cages to the hazards of freedom? Throughout my previous 2 years, my awakening had shown me new truths about my religion, my life, and the lives of women. I had survived a landslide of awarenesses, but I didn't know if I could act on them. When you can't go forward and you can't go backward and you can't stay where you are without killing off what is deep and vital in yourself, you are on the edge of creation. And so it was that I went that autumn afternoon to run my errands, walked into the drugstore, and found my daughter on her knees. As I listened to the man say, "That's how I like to see a woman, on her knees," something broke within me. I felt there was nothing more of that old life worth holding on to. I saw that this was not only just about me, it was about my daughter, it was about all the daughters everywhere. That day, I took my leave of the jar. I made an unconditional relationship with the journey. The sound of dragging feet ceased, and the silence was deafening. Later, I would think of the poet's line, "Kabir says, the only woman awake is the woman who has heard the flute." I thought of it because in the silence that followed, I began to hear the first strands of a music that has pulled me unceasingly ever since. I do not know what to name this music, except to say it comes from a place of hope in the feminine soul. It awakens us even as we awaken it. Part 2. Initiation. Now here was I, new awakened, with my hand stretching out and touching the unknown, the real unknown, the unknown unknown. D.H. Lawrence. The familiar life horizon has been outgrown. The old concepts, ideals, and emotional patterns no longer fit. The time for the passing of a threshold is at hand. Joseph Campbell. Death of the old form and new life or birth are fundamental to initiations. Jean Shinoda Bolen. The days grew shorter, and winter closed in. It seemed impossible that over 2 years had passed since the dream of birthing myself and the experience at the monastery that had started it all. I often found myself mulling over the events that had followed, the painful acknowledgement of the feminine wound, my exasperating resistance to the journey, the night with the dancing women on the beach. I recalled the sketches I'd made, then burned, the Magritte painting, unraveling the cultural images of womanhood, unnaming myself as woman so I could begin to remember who I was. I relived the intense months of reading and reading, forming my critique, truth-telling, anguish, and anger. Through all of this, I had conceived myself as woman. I had been reseeded. I thought often, too, of the old woman with the snake-twined stick who'd come in my dreams, the struggle to disentangle myself from patriarchal institutions and their wounding power, and to cast my lot, as theologian Carter Hayward writes, with those who resist unjust power relations. I thought of the struggle to make my husband understand the tensions I'd felt inside, those stymied, trapped, aching, ambivalent feelings, and I was grateful for the catalytic day I walked into the drugstore and found my daughter on her knees, because it caused me to get off mine. As I looked back, those events and images melded into my own unique landscape of awakening, into a craggy inner geography that I'd traveled but seemed now to be leaving for a different terrain. I had a vague sense of being perched on the lip of a new phase of experience, a whole new passage in my journey. I would never have thought to call it initiation, yet that's precisely what I was about to undergo. In the months ahead, I would plunge into a series of initiatory events, making my transit toward a new spirituality, toward sacred feminine experience, and a new way of being a woman. Initiation is a rite of passage, a crossing over, a movement between two worlds. For women on a journey such as this one, initiation is the great transition. Making this transition into sacred feminine experience can be beautiful and deeply moving, even cataclysmic in its effect on our lives. But it also means a time of ordeal, descent, darkness, and pain. In that experience of being formed anew, I may often feel torn asunder. Old aspects of my self-conception must die in order for my new transformation into selfhood to take place, writes feminist professor Penelope Washburn. If I had to reduce the meaning of initiation to just two words, they would be death and rebirth. Those are the essential tasks in any initiation, and especially they are the tasks of women who undergo initiation into feminist spiritual experience. The old forms, which grew small and confining as we woke, now crumble and give way as something new and large and mysterious rises up inside us. Attachment to the patriarchal world, which we've struggled to unname and unhinge, begins to dissolve and die away, and we are immersed in the feelings that go along with dyings. Initiation is a sacred disintegration. Despite its pain, we carry the conviction, often only faintly, that even though we don't know where we'll end up, we're following a soul path of immense richness, that we're supposed to be on this path, that it's required of us somehow. We move in a sense of rightness, of lure, of following a flute that pipes irresistible music. Early that winter, approaching initiation, I carried the sense of belonging on this path, but I knew nothing of the intensity I was about to enter. I only knew I had waked and was entering a place where the old meanings, concepts, and values no longer fit. The vista of the great transition. When landing in a place like this, usually the best thing to do is be still, be quiet, gather one's wits. Inside I felt queasy and alone, like I'd disembarked on some beautiful but unnamed island and was standing there watching the last boat recede into the distance. When a woman starts to disentangle herself from patriarchy, ultimately she is abandoned to her own self. She comes to an unknown place where she must let the old way of being woman die and the new way come forth. During initiation, the new feminine potential, that rambunctious girl child who was conceived and birthed inside during her awakening and who really had been there all along, starts to grow and develop into the woman she will be. The Unexplored Gorge. It was New Year's Eve. Sandy and I sat together in the den reading. We did that some years, avoiding the parties and staying home by the fire. I was reading Adrienne Rich's poetry, beautiful lines about moving through an unexplored gorge. I laid the book down and closed my eyes, trying to take in the image. Finally, I walked outside onto the patio and stared at the sky, clear and speckled with stars. The evening was not cold by December standards, not even December in the south. Before me hung a sliver of new moon, Behind me, light slanted out from the windows of the house. As I looked back through the French doors, suddenly the arrangement seemed all too symbolic. Me out here in the dark, looking back at a space both familiar and secure. The thought of an unexplored gorge filled me with mystery and love, yet at the same time, fear. The unexplored gorge, I repeated. I had found a name for the new terrain I was entering. But then I had another realization. Moving into a gorge implies descent. Self-captivity. Women's lives are made up of cycles of descent and ascent. At crucial times, we must seek out periods of inner solitude, deep brooding and being, intervals of spiritual apartness, where we move down into the depths of ourselves to mine the dark gorge and bring new treasure into the light. Years back, I'd visited the Cloisters in New York, a museum of medieval art and home of the famous unicorn tapestries, which had been woven around 1500. I was drawn to one tapestry in particular, the Unicorn in Captivity. It pictured the magical creature sitting alone inside a small circular fence beneath a tree, enclosed in a private space. This image of captivity and containment returned to me that New Year's Eve as a picture of what I needed, to capture myself, to bring my inner process with all its tensions into a contained and private space. According to Jungian analyst Karen Signell, the unicorn represents a woman's deep feminine center. It is her early feminine self, free and solitary, yet also highly vulnerable. This is the part of us that is newly developing, and at this stage it can be elusive, hidden, and difficult to contain. Like the unicorn, it can fade into the woods and be lost, writes Signell. It needs a safe inner sanctum, and a time to dwell there in separateness. I wanted to give myself this kind of space, to face what was happening, to let the small green shoot of my feminine soul have its hothouse. I needed an immediate retreat, but with writing deadlines piled on my desk, this was impossible. Flipping ahead in my calendar, I noticed a speaking engagement I had in California in late February. I decided to stay over for a while afterward, to let it become a place of self-captivity. I told Sandy about my plans one evening as we sat across from each other in the den. I told him my world was unraveling. I asked him to try to understand that I was tired of serving institutions designed to favor men while depriving women, that as a matter of fact, our marriage had in some ways been one of those institutions. I told him I needed time alone to sort through it, that I was going to take several days away. He squeezed the little hump of flesh between his eyebrows. "Don't," he sighed. He was talking about more than my going away. He was talking about the whole journey, and we both knew it. I didn't say anything. He kept rubbing his thumb across his open palm. "I don't understand what you're doing," he said. "This journey you're on. I wish..." He shook his head. He wished I would cease and desist. That's what he wished. I thought how scary it must be to have a wife of nearly 20 years wake up. About 5,000 years of repressed feminine wisdom and strength are simmering in the cells of her body, and something way down inside him knows this, knows that if it ever gets loose, life as he knows it is over. I was silent a long time. I loved him deeply, but how could I deny this journey? Women had made whole careers of self-abnegation and sacrifice because we've been told this was the noblest way, the Christian way. But was it noble to cling to passivities and diminishments, to love ourselves so little we smothered any flame in our own souls? In my favorite Mae Sarton novel, The Reckoning, Ella writes to her friend Laura, "Do you suppose growing up always means diluting our fierce purpose for the sake of others?" In some ways, spiritual development for women, perhaps unlike that for men, is not about surrendering self so much as coming to self. "I have to do this," I told him softly. "I really have to." His whole body went limp, reminding me of a glove when a hand has just been withdrawn. There seemed no fight left in him. He got up and walked away. In a moment of sadness, I wondered what would become of us. He didn't understand the extraordinary passion in my heart for this journey.